Welcome, everyone, and thanks for listening to the Let's Brief It podcast, a podcast made for law students by law students.
I am Fabiola Uera, a student at Georgetown University Law Center.
And I'm Andrew Nettles, a student at GW Law. And in today's episode, we're going to be exploring legal writing with Ryan McCarl, whose book Elegant Legal Writing was recently published in February. Ryan McCarl earned his JD at the University of Chicago Law School, an MA in International Relations and BA in Political Science from the University of Chicago, and also an MA in Education from the University of Michigan. He's the author of Elegant Legal Writing and a founding partner of the business litigation firm Rushing McCarl LLP, based in California. He has given talks about legal writing, appellate advocacy, and litigation strategy to audiences, including the ABA and the Texas Office of the Attorney General. Previously, Mr. McCarl was a fellow in artificial intelligence law and policy at the UCLA School of Law, where he designed and taught advanced legal writing and researched the use of artificial intelligence in the legal profession. He frequently publishes scholarly work and recently released his first book. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ryan.
Thank you for having me.
Starting off, how would you describe legal writing to a 1L law student who might be listening today and who might also have a bad taste in their mouth from legal writing generally?
Sure. So to start with the first part of that question, legal writing is about teaching in litigation, at any rate, is about teaching the judge the analytical moves and law needed to apply the law correctly and reach a decision in your client's favor. So it's writing to inform and to persuade. So setting aside drafting legal instruments like contracts or wills that have actual legal effect, all other parts of legal writing in litigation, litigation adjacent, internal memos, letters to clients, things along those lines, it's all about basically conveying the information that is going to be most helpful to the reader in as efficient a way as possible. And what I advocate in my book, Elegant Legal Writing, is to really put yourself in the reader's mindset and think about their cognitive limitations in terms of time, in terms of motivation, in terms of attention span, and realize that they're reading your work out of a sense of duty, not pleasure, and that they have more documents available for them to read than and required technically for them to read than in fact they have time for. So with busy trial court judges that may have anywhere from 200 to 1200 active cases on their docket, it's impossible for any human being to read all those filings that come across their desk. So they are only going to read so much of your briefs as they believe will be helpful to them. And so with that in mind, I advocate getting the judge's attention right at the beginning, showing that you're going to be helpful in helping them do their job right at the beginning, and then thinking about how to sustain their motivation throughout the brief by writing in a concise, compelling, aesthetically pleasing way and getting right to the point and then stopping. So that's the general philosophy of legal writing that I follow. With respect to advice to 1Ls specifically and law students generally, I think that sometimes legal writing classes are de-emphasized in the minds of law students for whatever reason. Maybe they have different curves or whatever the reason is than the substantive classes in the 1L curriculum. And I think all the classes are important, but I would say that legal writing is really the fundamental skill of lawyering. If you truly don't like to write, I don't know that you're in the right profession. And you'll have to either change the mindset or change direction or really aim at a certain type of law that doesn't require as much of it. But the law is really primarily about written communication. There are certainly depositions and some hearings, some trials, and negotiations that put a primacy on oral advocacy skills. But by and large, for most litigators day to day, the advocacy is happening in writing, even in trials. If you wanted to be a trial lawyer, a great deal of what happens there is submitting trial briefs, written motions, evidentiary motions before the trial and during the trial, motions to amend the pleadings, motions to exclude certain evidence. And being able to write about those well not only helps you clarify your thinking so you make better arguments, but it allows you to have an advantage in making those arguments, even if you're also making them verbally. So it's really impossible to understate the importance of it. From a practical career perspective, I could tell you that, my own firm, Rushing McCarl LLP, we're a business litigation boutique in California. And when we do a round of hiring, the writing samples are really the easiest way for us to quickly, call 95% of the applicants. And really, no matter how good your grades are or whether you're under rental or whether you have a great work experience background, if the writing isn't there, at least fundamentally sound, and so it appears that we can, coach you to write at our level very quickly, then you know, then it just won't work for us. And I think there's quite a few firms on the higher end of the spectrum that take a similar approach, and they're just not going to be able to hire somebody that seems like they may have problems with fundamental grammar mechanics or difficulty making sound coherent arguments. So it's impossible to overstate the importance of it. And it's also, I think that if you really, really struggle with writing and have a dislike for it, it does interfere with your enjoyment of the job, because so much of the job is built around that. And conversely, if you can learn to enjoy writing and seek growth to try to become a better writer, just as if you were working on a musical instrument your whole life, it can make the work much more enjoyable and fulfilling. So you can, no matter your current writing skills, you can develop writing into a bit of a comparative advantage and, you know, go out of your way to read books like mine, go to legal education seminars, take more law school courses in that direction, and make it what you do especially well. And that will take you very far.
In my experience, in touching back on that, legal writing frameworks that were taught in law school, such as CREAC, TREAT, and IRAC, don't necessarily transfer over into real life practice. And it shouldn't. I find those frameworks to be quite limiting. I know that you've discussed this before in your blog, and I was wondering what your thoughts on these frameworks were.
Sure. So I've been working on writing about legal argumentation as part of a next project. I also cover some of that in Elegant Legal Writing. And I do have a chapter or section there about IRAC and CREAC and similar frameworks. I don't find those to be especially helpful. I think that they oversimplify legal reasoning, and there's quite a few different varieties of legal argument and legal problem that just don't really fit well into those frameworks. And defenders of the frameworks can tweak them and can expand them or qualify them and come up with ways to squeeze those in to the frameworks. But ultimately, you know, at some point, it's the tail wagging the dog, as they say. And in my opinion, the main thing that's wrong with them is that they tend to lead, it does lead to a stilted form of writing if you try to apply it too formulaically, which, you know, obviously hurts the reader's interest and motivation to continue. You know, no good writing is typically written in such a completely structured, inflexible way, paragraph by paragraph, as some people try to apply CREAC. It's just that becomes monotonous quite quickly. But really, more importantly, on the argument side, I find that a lot of law students spend too much time writing rule statements, both on exams and in memos and in briefs. And then they often will kind of juxtapose the rule alongside the facts and say, therefore, the conclusion. But setting them side by side like that is not enough. It's really the magic of good legal arguments, and the essence of what's being argued over really requires focusing on that application prong of weaving the facts and law together, mutually adjusting your characterization of the rule to an accurate characterization of the facts, and using the facts to select the right rule, and then looking at the rule for guidance as to what facts are legally material, and then describing the facts as meeting that or not meeting it. That's kind of the gist of most legal argumentation in any kind of contested or difficult motion. And it doesn't really fit under those frameworks because it all happens within that analysis prong and not the other prongs. I do believe in the basic principle of, as I teach it, I tell people to write about conclusions plus reasons. So you start by writing, you know, your legal conclusion or takeaway at the beginning, and then you provide backing for it by combining propositions of law, propositions of fact, and showing how they interact to produce your conclusion. But what's especially important is that people understand that rule statements are not by themselves reasons, and statements of facts are not by themselves reasons. And if you put them out there in a standalone way without showing how they mutually interact, then chances are you're being conclusory, because you may just be saying, here's the standard for a motion to dismiss, here's what they say, therefore the motion to dismiss should be granted. And that's not going to get it done. It's all about selecting the right rule, establishing that that is the applicable rule and that's not some other rule that's applicable, and then that the facts in front of the court fit squarely within that rule and mandate the conclusion you want.
I like how you are emphasizing on the fact of capturing the reader's interest. Is it fair to say that the content of the book transcends the legal audience?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've heard from creative writing professors, undergraduate composition professors, other non-lawyers and people teaching non-lawyers that have found the book to be especially helpful. There's really maybe three chapters in the middle that are in the substance section, I guess I call it, where I talk about legal argumentation, using legal authority, and writing legal narratives, legal storytelling. Those are specific to litigation, but the rest of the book, although it uses legal examples and talks about litigation all the time, all the rest of it is really generally applicable. So I have included a chapter in there about my favorite productivity techniques and tactics, overcoming procrastination, and so on, following a sound writing process, using kind of more advanced technology tips that people don't necessarily know about as often, like, for example, using text expansion to quickly turn snippets of text into full sentences or paragraphs. And all that translates across fields. And so does the sort of the general principles of a writing style and prose mechanics and the approach to writing, which emphasizes efficiency, readability, and a reader-oriented approach. I think anytime you're writing for a professional audience, any interest the writer may have in kind of self-expression or writing for their own sake or their own purposes has to always be subordinated to a realization that you're just trying to help people and communicate a point and make it persuasively if it's a persuasive document. And those are all reader-centric ends. And so learning how to write with the reader foremost in your mind and with specific actionable techniques to make points more efficiently and write sentences that are easier to follow and paragraphs that are unified and cohesive and so on, those all have to do with general prose composition. So quite a few of the books that I read and studied before I started teaching legal writing and wrote the book were themselves books about general composition, not just legal writing.
And sort of touching on that, and I think you discussed it a lot, how would you describe your style of writing to an older practitioner audience? And is both your experiences teaching legal writing and also practicing using legal writing, is there anything that in recent years you would say marked the departure from the old archaic legalese style of legal writing that older practitioners have grown accustomed to?
Well, I think tradition plays a big role in the culture of the legal profession, and people's habits and beliefs tend to be passed down from supervisor to associate and then get kind of perpetuated. There's also a lot of risk aversion and kind of a fear that if you do something that's different, you know, what rule allows that? Or, you know, that's different from other contracts I've seen or briefs I've seen. You know, maybe I need to say things like comes now before the court at the beginning of the complaint, or maybe I need to say prayer for relief at the end of the complaint. Or I need to say terms and conditions instead of just terms when I'm talking about a contract. It's a sense of fear and a sense of, well, this is how it's always been done. That can kind of lock people in to habits and practices that don't actually make any sense and really hinder the goal of communicating to the reader and making their document pleasant to read. So I always encourage people to, you know, to try to distinguish between doing something because it's always been done that way versus doing something because it's the most effective way to reach the reader. So as for my own style, I would say that, you know, I've tried to convey the most important kind of techniques that lead into it in the book. But I guess in terms of a style perspective, I try to write, and I recommend that others try to write like a writer of popular nonfiction rather than like a lawyer, so to speak. So I read periodicals like The New Yorker, for example, or The New York Review of Books that have long form feature writing and oftentimes about complex or abstruse topics that, you know, are not necessarily less complex than the law. Sometimes about science, sometimes about AI, whatever it may be. And yet those writers, they know that they are writing for people that have an option to not read it. And with that in mind, they write in such a way as to convey information, but also make it pleasant to read. So I take a bit of that in terms of my model, writing like, you know, a writer of strong general nonfiction. And then in terms of on the argumentation side and the selecting what information to include side, I really just try to get right to the point and focus on including in the main text of the brief exactly the information that the judge needs to know to rule in favor of my clients. And anything that is self-explanatory, I try to remove. Anything that is superfluous or redundant, of which there's always a lot in any first draft, I try to remove. Things that are purely technical or reference material, like record citations or citations for, you know, like to Ashcroft v. Iqbal for the pleading standard or some other kind of general citation that every judge knows, that all goes in footnotes for me. And I guess the other thing I would note as characteristic of my own style, two things. One is I use a lot of visual aids and white space in the briefs. A lot of clients and other people comment on that. Our use of evidence in our briefs. We pioneered the use of QR codes to share video clips with courts in our briefs. And, you know, and I'm also not afraid to use tables, screenshots, bullet points, whatever's the most easy to read way for the reader to understand the information that I'm trying to convey. And I would say that along with that, I also don't write in a case-centric way. And this is a pretty big difference between how I write and teach writing versus how I think a lot of law students learn it. I see legal arguments as being conclusions supported by reasons. So in other words, similar to any other form of argument, in that you are providing the premises needed to reach a conclusion, and then you're defending the challenged premises. And, you know, the ones that are going to be challenged or going to arouse skepticism, you go out of your way to back those up. And therefore, I think in terms of propositions and reasons for them, and the only reason to discuss a case, in my view, is to support a legal proposition. Legal cases by themselves, they're kind of similar to rule statements. Their only role in an argument is to support one of your premises that supports one of your conclusions. So with that in mind, I think that a lot of law students make the mistake of building paragraphs around case discussions, discussing cases too much in the main text of their brief. And instead, I recommend focusing on what conclusion do I want to advance in this part of the brief, or what proposition am I supporting? And then what's the most effective way to support it? And that often usually does include relying on a case, but there's only a need to discuss a case if the proposition is contested. And if the proposition is contested, it may be that no particular case has to be discussed in the main text of the brief. It may be a situation where a footnote and a parenthetical suffices. So I talk a lot about different ways to make those judgment calls in the brief. But what I do encourage people to move away from is starting paragraphs with a sentence that is built around a case, like in Smith v. Jones, the court held such and such. That is a really good concrete example of something that's not reader oriented, because the court first needs to understand why that case is even being talked about, why it matters. And that means leading with the proposition that the case supports, and then only then supplying the information about the case as backing for the proposition.
Are modern legal writing trends, in your view, compatible with what some might refer to as the traditional model of legal academia, such as what I would say is an over-reliance on footnoting by law journals and their students?
So I think, you know, each culture within academia has its own sort of expectations and requirements, and the legal writing for practitioners versus legal writing for scholarship are really, they're different genres. You know, and I've done both. I've done a number of law review articles in addition to the book and in addition to practicing. But I would say that some of the general principles of writing in a reader-oriented way and trying to be helpful quickly, trying to be efficient, supporting propositions that are contested at length, but not ones that are self-evident, those all apply just as much and can help you write more effectively, even if you're writing a law review article. Footnotes are a pretty good example. I'm an advocate of using footnotes quite liberally in legal briefs, and I think that their use in, you know, journal articles is appropriate insofar as, you know, you're providing support, or you're writing an aside, you're providing additional information. Anything that's not in the body of the text, only things in the body of the text should be really what's required to follow your argument in a somewhat minimal way, and then, you know, and strengthen it as you go. But stuff that's really directly on point, all the other information, you know, can go in footnotes. As I talk about in the book, there's this principle of information hiding or progressive disclosure. It's sometimes described that user experience experts use and web designers, which is that you provide information to the user when they need it and if they need it and not before. And you help readers visually distinguish between important information and secondary information. And to me, that same principle can apply to selecting what goes in the main text versus what's in the footnotes. But perhaps more to the point of your question, I believe that, you know, for example, in practice, if I mentioned the 12b6 motion to dismiss standard, since that's familiar, or since, you know, what a standard of review is familiar, and a lot of legal rules are familiar, like what are the elements of a breach of contract claim, what are the elements of a tort conversion claim, those sort of familiar black letter law elements typically need to only be supported by, you know, one citation to binding authority, which can be put in a footnote. And then as the proposition becomes more debatable or contested or likely to arouse questions from the court, then you support it more. And really the same goes for when you're writing a law review article. What I don't like is footnotes that just seem like the writer made a trip to the library and just included 10 sources for the sake of 10 sources. I think that in all writing for professional audiences, the goal is to be helpful to the reader and communicate information to the reader, which requires removing redundancy and removing things that are not particularly important. Prime examples of that would be sort of superfluous citations for the same point.
You did some research on the use of artificial intelligence in the legal profession. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of integrating generative AI in legal practice, particularly in what we are talking about in legal writing?
So I think that generative AI, even at its current state, has a lot of helpful uses. For example, if you need to just kind of get a superficial background knowledge about a new area of law, you know, it may be worth asking a service to explain it to you just to get you started, not to cite. Same thing with fact situations. This weekend, I was writing a motion to dismiss in a case involving local FedEx shipping routes. And I didn't know the term that was being used to describe those or know anything about FedEx's business structure. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that you learn in practice, but they don't teach in law school. You learn it case by case. And so, you know, so I went and, you know, used some generative AI to ask questions about what that is. How does it work? What is the structure? And of course, I can't use that or cite it or anything like that, but it made some things click for me that immediately triggered thoughts about legal challenges to the complaint with respect to, you know, the definition of the collateral, the secure transactions rules, conversion rules, and so on. Now with that better factual understanding, I can go find cases that are on point and develop an argument. Generative AI is also useful sometimes for finding research leads. Its ability to answer questions in what's called natural language rather than technical search queries can allow you to, even if you don't know the precise concept or you once knew it, but you've forgotten it, or you know the name of the doctrine, res ipsa loquitur, for example, if you forget exactly what that was called, but you know the general idea that there are some torts where the fact of the wrong leads to an implication that somebody was negligent. Generative AI is especially good at being able to take indirect, partial descriptions of what you're trying to achieve and then point you to the name of the doctrine you were looking for. It's also useful for if you can craft good research prompts and use a service like Casetext, which I've used for many years and was recently bought by Thomson Reuters. If you can use those as a sort of a first cut of finding a starting point for your research, that can be effective. I think that it's also better to do it in tandem with traditional methods. And also the most important thing to understand about that, well, I guess the first thing is that one of the difficult things about legal research is that it's hard to find a starting point. And finding that starting point, something to grab onto in the cases and in the treatises and statutes, is really where a lot of the art of it is and a lot of trial and error involved. And sometimes the generative AI software like that can point you to a line of cases or entire doctrines that you might have missed through traditional methods. So I use them in tandem with traditional methods. And the important thing to understand to stay out of trouble and to use them appropriately and not be one of these lawyers that keeps ending up in the news every week by citing fake cases is to understand that when you are practicing, everything you do is constrained by and informed by the rules of ethics, which include a duty of competence and a duty of transparency and candor to the tribunal, as they call it, telling the truth to the court about what the law is and so on. And all of those different ethical rules point you to the conclusion that you need to verify what you're saying. You're hired for your legal expertise and judgment and not to regurgitate what some form book says or what ChatGPT says or what LegalZoom says. So what you have to do is understand that different research, AI-backed research services, just like any research service, is always just a starting point. And you have to do the hard work of, you know, running down the cases, shepherdizing the cases to make sure there's still good law, actually reading them to make sure that, in fact, the facts and holding are on point, checking treatises to make sure you have a full understanding of the area of law rather than just kind of plugging in citations about something you don't really understand. And all that means that AI services can only be part of the input. They can never be the final answer. And that's never going to change, in my opinion, that you always have to, as a lawyer, double check. And you always have to acquire an understanding of the area of doctrine. And if you try to delegate that to any kind of machine or even to a subordinate, for that matter, it just isn't going to go well.
So glad to hear that you are not going to be replaced.
Yes.
Before we close, are there any final thoughts that you would like to offer to our law student audience?
I would just say that I recommend seeing what you're doing now in law school as the beginning of, you know, the rest of your career and a professional journey, reminding yourself that even if practicing law is stressful, it's really a privilege. You know, it's for those of us who, for the most part, don't know math and science and don't really work well with our hands. So to make ourselves useful to the world, this is a pretty good way to do it, because navigating complexity, legal complexity, is a real service for your clients. And it's a privilege to be able to do it. And I would say that, you know, go into your classes and choose your classes and choose your experiences with the mindset of being kind of a lifelong self-educator. Take responsibility for learning an area of law. If you think about a course, like when you take evidence, you know, or any other black letter law course, think about it as I'm here to learn evidence, and the class and the readings are just one source of input. They may be the primary source of input, but nevertheless, if you don't learn the hearsay rule well enough to do well on an exam, it's not the professor's fault. It's because you didn't take advantage of the innumerable resources available to help explain that rule to you. And so I think having that self-educator growth mindset right from the beginning will make the experience of law school more pleasant, and it will help you build the habits of continued growth that will lead to a richer career and make the job that you ultimately get more fun.
Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today. And we would like to thank the DC Bar communities for hosting us. And thank you to everyone for listening today.
Thank you.
The DC Bar Law Student Community strives to engage and support law students before you graduate and expose you to the tangible benefits of joining the DC Bar and DC Bar communities. Curated programming allows law students to participate in leadership trainings, substantive content programming, networking with practicing attorneys in fields of interest, writing opportunities, and other activities designed to expand your legal education beyond the classroom. Make an investment in your legal career by joining the law student community. To learn more, visit us at www.dcbar.org or email communities@dcbar.org.